I want to give a title to this podcast. It's called Different Life Everywhere. You know, there's a great app that I use. It's called EarthCam. I don't even know how I found it. It's like $2 for a year. And what's great about it is you can look at the live cams, streaming live cams from all over the earth. Wherever they have a camera set up, they kind of develop this network in real time where you can, you know, even if it's 3 a.m. in Bahrain, if there's a camera that's hooked up to this EarthCam network, you can at least see, you know, they have them all over the place. And it's amazing because you can go to these places that you've never been, maybe won't ever have the opportunity to go, like the Maldives or Guam or Thailand or Costa Rica or Sweden, Belgium. How about Abbey Road, where the Beatles took the snapshot of them crossing the street? I mean, how great is it that, you know, people from all over the world, somebody had to put that camera up, and they're just everywhere. They have a lot of them in the United States, but I like looking in places that I didn't even know existed just to see, you know, what picture's there. And it's very high quality, and sometimes you can hear the audio too. That's always nice. So you can put it on your TV if you wanted to nowadays with Bluetooth, and you can wake up every morning to the, you know, to what it might be like if you were in Thailand or Honolulu, right? And sometimes it's city centers, so you can see traffic. Like I think in either Hungary or Bulgaria, they have a real good shot of what looks like a giant roundabout downtown area. Now, you know, these cameras don't show close-ups of people, so it's not like we're invading anybody's privacy. Mainly what you see is just the activity that's going on. Sometimes they're great nature shots like seascapes. In Costa Rica, they've got one where you can see a volcano. It's a remote area. How they got power there, maybe it's on a solar thing. Anyway, what's most fascinating, though, and the reason I'm sharing it with you, is because it's a glorious thing to see the world and all of her different flavors and shades. And it's also interesting that in many places where you would think there would be live cams, there aren't. You know, there's only one in England. I just told you, the one about Abbey Road. But I don't think they have any in Paris, Germany. And it got me to thinking, maybe these places don't want unwanted visitors peering into their countries. And of course, there's none in China. You know, which is interesting because you know that these countries are heavily surveilled. Anyway, that's not my point. But, you know, I'm hopeful that at some point they can set up cameras in poorer areas or areas just outside of the nice areas so that we could see what the other half of life really looks like up close. You know, the life that isn't so pretty, but it's just as real. And the app, again, it's called EarthCam, if you want to look at it, is looking at various shots, and it actually kind of brings me some calm. It makes me kind of get out of my own life, and it transports me to other places that, like I said, I may never see, but I can dream, and what it's like to be there and think about the people who are there and what their life must be like. When you think about that, sometimes you can get insights as to how you might adapt or live in such a place. And one thing that is noticeable in a lot of these shots is that people seem to be the same in all of the streams, where you see people getting along, people from every walk of life coexisting peacefully, doing basically what people do in every neighborhood, in every city on earth. We act like intelligent human beings for the most part. And so as an aside, we can also take the point of view of our unseen friends in the seraphic arena of life just above us. They see us as we are, where we are, as well. So that's an interesting concept, the idea that we're not so much being watched, but we're coexisting with these unseen friends. They have the advantage, of course, of being able to see us as we are, but you know, obviously we have material eyes. We're limited in our light range. We don't see them. Maybe someday we will as we evolve. but we can only know by faith that angels and fellow guardians do in fact coexist. According to the Urantia book and according to scripture, they minister to us. And the UB covers a lot of that, some of which we've discussed in previous podcasts. But what we really haven't delved into, at least as far as I can reckon in my history of the series, have we talked about what life might be like on some of the other worlds based on what the Urantia book tells us? Our scientists, our astronomers are getting closer, and they correctly surmise that if intelligent life does exist, and statistically it seems likely at this point, just because of the number of stars that are out there. Now, you know, when I was growing up, they used to say the opposite. They would say that, you know, the elements that go into making life are so complex that it would be a rare event. It would be very hard to get just everything right. And of course, you know, we've adapted a little bit. Some of us call that proof that there is intelligent design, and we've talked about that. But, you know, the Urantia book says that life is extensive. It's more in line with what you would see on Star Trek or Star Wars, right? They're saying life, it exists all over the place. And that's the standard. That's the rule, not the exception. And it also declares, much as consistent with science, that every life on every world is different, highly adapted to that environment. And the Urantia book goes into that. And we're going to share some of that in a second. And it also says that humans of will and spirit potential exist on all kinds of worlds, some slightly larger than our world, some smaller, some beings are taller, others shorter. They even go into some depths about brain hemispheres as being a part of a classification. There are worlds with three brain humans and those with just one hemisphere. And that refers to the hemispheric design that we have. We have a left brain and a right brain. They tell us that on worlds with three brain types, there are far more spiritual and intellectual than compared to us. And still on other worlds, some humans have much better vision and hearing than we do. And the Urantia book says that Urantia, our world, is about average in terms of temperature, atmosphere, the fact that we walk upright, which is standard for all evolutionary will creatures, and that our ancestors, our own ancestors, started out as sea animals and even later as tree dwellers. And as mind evolved and our bodies evolved, to our present state with periodic help from above. And so this is why it is probably unlikely that aliens could just come here and start living here and take over, right? You know, that's the big thing now in ufology is, you know, have you heard of the lizard people? It's kind of strange, but then you got the grays and you got all these, you know, I think they made this point in War of the Worlds, didn't they? Towards the end, you know, you have to be adapted to the life that you're in. And then the Urantia book makes that claim. But I want to spend a minute or two just kind of sharing with you some of their own words in describing these other places, giving us a kind of a keyhole into what life might be like beyond our own world. So reading from paper 49, and we'll just start from the beginning and kind of go through a summary reading, kind of give you an overall view, and I'll just read it. It says, all mortal inhabited worlds are evolutionary in origin and nature. These spheres are the spawning ground, the evolutionary cradle of the immortal races of time and space. Each unit of the ascendant life is a veritable training school for the stage of existence just ahead. And this is true of every stage of man's progressive paradise ascent, just as true of the initial mortal experience on an evolutionary planet as of the final universal headquarters school of the Melchizedeks. A school which is not attended by ascendant mortals until just before their translation to the regime of the super universe and the attainment of the first stage spirit existence. Paper 49 and then paragraph 4. Not all planets are suited to harbor mortal life. Some ones have a high rate of axial revolution and are wholly unsuited for life habitats. In several of the physical systems of our system, the planets revolve around a central sun and are too large for habitation. their great mass occasioning oppressive gravity. Many of these enormous spheres have satellites, some a half dozen or more, and these moons are often in size very near that of our world, Urantia, so that they're almost ideal for habitation. So they're giving us this picture of how different solar systems exist and what are the conditions that need, and what they're explaining here is that, you know, there is a Goldilocks zone. Can't be too small, you can't be too big, can't be too close to big stars. But, you know, this poses a question that, you know, in a planet like Jupiter, which is too big to harbor life, maybe one of its moons does. Or Saturn. And we've long suspected that some of these moons are quite capable of harboring some kind of life form. We're kind of getting closer to that. So from paper 49, paragraph 5, the oldest inhabited world of Satania, world number 1, is Anova. Anova, one of the 44 satellites revolving around an enormous dark planet, but exposed to the differential light of 3 neighboring suns. I wonder if that's a kind of a clue, right? Anova is in an advanced stage of progressive civilization. All of the worlds of a local system disclose unmistakable physical kinship. Nevertheless, each planet has its own scale of life, no two worlds being exactly alike in plant and animal endowment. These planetary variations in the system life types result from the decisions of the life carrier suns. These are the orders of beings, and they're neither capricious nor whimsical. The universes are conducted in accordance with law and order. I think that's why they tell us this. That's what they're trying to explain to us. There's no mystery here. Evolution is the rule of human development, but the process itself varies greatly on different worlds. Life is sometimes initiated in one center, sometimes in 3, as it was on Urantia. On the atmospheric worlds, it usually has a marine origin, but not always. Much depends on the physical status of a planet. Like life carriers have great latitude in their function of life initiation. So again, law and order, rule. Things are planned. It's not haphazard, capricious, or whimsical. We didn't get here by accident. Boy, you know, if you read about how life came here, they bring in all of these elements that we hadn't even, you know, realized at this point. We think of what happens on our terrestrial world, the amount of heat versus the amount of light. But they're saying that even the cosmic rays and the angle by which you are, you know, in proximity to your sun, other energy forms that we're not even aware of all conspire to make it just right for life to appear. And life carriers have great latitude in coordinating these the physical spatial environment. In fact, if you do a Google on spatial environment, that's where they explain just how intricate it is to bring about, you know, evolutionary worlds of time and space. Spatial environment. So on the non-breathers, so now we get to this little section that talks about all the different kinds of life forms, but it gets specific about one life form, which are known as the non-breathers. And it gets kind of interesting here. So from paper 49, it says, the majority of inhabited planets are peopled with the breathing type of intelligent beings, but there are also orders of mortals who are able to live on worlds with little or no air. I remember reading one of these, who's the Isaac Asimov? He wrote a short story about that very thing, about, you know, living beings that lived on planets with no air. I wonder where we got that idea from. Of the Orvinton inhabited worlds, that's Orvinton is the name of our super universe, one of 7. Orvinton inhabited worlds, this type of non-breather world accounts for less than 7%. And in Nebadon, which is our local universe, headed by our own Christ Michael, has a percentage of less than 3%. So less than 3% of the inhabited worlds are worlds of non-breathers. And in all, in our local system, there are only 9 such worlds out of potentially 1,000. From paper 49, Section 3, Paragraph 6, you would be more than interested in the planetary conduct of this type of mortal because such a race of beings inhabits a sphere in close proximity to Urantia. And people in the Urantia community have been speculating about this for decades. What are they talking about? Are they making reference to a planet that's in our own solar system? Are there already a planet in our solar system that has life, that's been here all this time, but they're non-breathers? Is that why they gave us the clue? Is that what we're going to discover? Wouldn't that be something? If we ended up discovering a planet, you know, we're getting close to Ganymede, we're getting close to Europa, Triton, I think, one of those two planets. Let me continue on because this gets really interesting in describing what this world is like. And if there's one in close proximity to us, maybe this discloses a few clues. From paper 49, section 3, paragraph 4. Life on the worlds of the non-breathers is radically different from what it is on Urantia. The non-breathers do not eat food or drink water as do the Urantia races. The reactions of the nervous system, the heat-regulating mechanism, and the metabolism of these specialized people are radically different from such functions on Urantia mortals. Almost every act of living, aside from reproduction, differs, and even the methods of procreation are somewhat different. On the non-breathing worlds, the animal species are radically unlike those found on atmospheric planets. The non-breathing plan of life varies from the techniques of existence on an atmospheric world. Even in survival, their peoples differ, being candidates for spirit fusion. So they don't even actually do what we do, where we are we fuse with the Father Spirit, the Thought Adjuster. Nevertheless, these beings enjoy life and carry forward the activities of the realm with the same relative trials and joys that are experienced by the mortals living on atmospheric worlds. In mind and character, the non-breathers do not differ from any other mortal type. That's fascinating, isn't it? So what they're basically giving us all kinds of clues. There's not a lot of water because they don't need it. They're living on a world that's prone to getting decimated by meteorites. They talk about that. And it has no atmosphere, or at least one that doesn't sustain them in the... They're almost like lizards, right? And they even procreate, which means they probably have a male and female. But in mind and character, they're the same. But the way they even have children or offspring is different. So there are some clues as we, you know, the Urantia book offering an insight, right? So, you know what? You know, you might be asking, why does the book share this information? What spiritual value does such information contain, right? The writers are asking us to believe them, to anticipate someday even being able to visit this world during our spiritual ascent as resurrected children of God. I mean, eventually when we graduate to that next place, we will be able to look back. We will have somewhat access to other kinds of life, right? We assume that. That's what the Urantia book tells us. So, you know, earlier when I told you about the EarthCam app, the Urantia book, in a way, provides a universe cam, a way of seeing through the revelation how the universe is constructed to illustrate that our creation, the living universe, is not just an accident. It has purpose and there is a plan. Isn't that why we're looking with our telescopes and our spaceships? Isn't that why we're looking for life? Life gives meaning, hope, that we're not alone. And when man does find that he is not alone, his whole outlook on this present state changes. When we start to see ourselves as part of a much larger aggregate, which is what the Urantia revelation seeks to do, we see ourselves in a different, perhaps even more meaningful life. You know, I was talking to a young person the other day, and he tells me, he talks to a lot of his friends, and you know, all the young people today are connected like crazy to social media. Social media, it's... They say that the general feeling among younger people is, what's the point? You know, they fear climate change. They don't know capitalism is very complicated for them. That's why socialism has such a great appeal, because they like the idea of getting something for nothing, and they're surrounded by wealth, so they assume there's plenty to go around. until there isn't. Then, of course, you know, young people dealing with COVID, you know, everybody's dealing with that, old people, young people. And as far as religion goes, young people today have been absolutely brainwashed to ignore anything that even, although I'm not convinced that all of that brainwashing has resulted in a lack of spiritual hunger. I still think the hunger is there. And this is why I think the Urantia book becomes relevant, because it offers hope. And the world is your oyster, and apparently so is the universe.
The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors, so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot.